Now for our faculty introductions, we have two wonderful faculty with us today. First, we have Andy Ginigundo from the Cincinnati Cancer Advisors, as well as Fred Hirsch from the Mount Sinai School of Medicine. I'm going to turn the program over to them now, and thank you all for coming.
Thank you. She was so nervous about that Ginigundo business. So the weird stuff that we, you know, when you're a speaker, number one, it's like, please, you know, don't fall off the stage. It's like, you think this is so stable, like the stage is always, no, this isn't like your high school. These stages, like, they built this like yesterday or something. So you could fall off these stages. And then we always like pretend like we know these people from, you know, no, Ginigundo doesn't always come off the tongue. So today we are talking about small cell lung cancer, kind of an overview, but I'll get the management of limited stage, and let's just get going here. Let's talk about a case here. 63-year-old gentleman presents with a persistent cough, dyspnea, and recurrent respiratory infections over the past 2 months. He has a 40-pack-year smoking history. CT shows a central mass in the right lung with mediastinal lymph node involvement, consistent with limited-stage small cell lung cancer. Further workup shows no evidence of distant disease, hence the limited stage. So a little bit of food for thought here, or case discussion. So what factors should guide you in your selection of first-line treatment for this patient? Which first-line treatment would be most appropriate for this patient, and which AEs would you be vigilant about? I will bet you I will talk about all of those things. So think in your mind what you think the answers to those questions are. So this is the recommended, I call it the historical approach of limited stage small cell lung cancer. If you look on the left side of that graphic there, you see there, okay, we've decided it's limited stage. So if you're not all that familiar with small cell, we're a little bit odd in the small cell department, where we just say you're either limited stage or you're extensive stage. So there's a corresponding TNM staging 1, 2, 3, 4. But think about, if it's limited stage, that's what you can fit within a single radiation field. So if you have a lung with maybe a lymph node, but liver involvement, well, okay, that's not a single radiation field. Or you have both lungs involved, well, that's not a single radiation field, that's extensive stage. Here we're talking about the limited stage on the left side there, the corresponding stage 1 to 2. When they do that mediastinal staging, so that mediastinum, that space between the lungs, right? If you have negative mediastinal, you're negative for mediastinal disease, that's potentially operable disease. So you can have a lobectomy, lymph node dissection and sampling, and then systemic therapy plus or minus radiation therapy. But look at the other side there. So there are many cases where this doesn't happen. So you do your mediastinal staging, and lo and behold, there's disease. So our case study showed that there was a mediastinal lymph node that was involved. So if they are better performance status, and I always think, okay, ECOG is like golf, and you know the Masters is going on right now. So the lower your score, the better you are. If you're 0 to 2, you should be thinking, okay, we give this person chemo and radiation therapy at the same time. If they are of questionable, you know, toughness, or not toughness. I mean, I don't want to say people be tough, but not ready for that. You're just not able to get that kind of treatment. You're ECOG 3 or 4. You don't want to be ECOG 5, because that means you're dead. So we're not going to treat any of those people who are ECOG 5. But ECOG 3 or 4, systemic therapy, so you get your chemo, plus or minus radiation therapy. You can give it together. You give one after another, right? So you could say, okay, here's your chemo, here's your radiation, and that might be gentler to receive it in a person who has a lower performance status. So the current, and I'd say the historical part of this, all this is true right now, but that ECOG 0 to 2 concurrent radiotherapy, is there a next step there? What is the next big thing? It just seems like the technology, the advances in small cell have taken a long, long time, decades, really, to get to this point where, oh, there's an extra box. We get to talk about an extra box in this. So let's figure out what this is. So here's our approach to limited stage small cell lung cancer. So you can consider surgical resection and adjuvant chemotherapy for very early stage. So I always think these people are the ones that, oh, I was in a car accident and my airbag went off, and they go, oh, we need to check a chest x-ray, make sure you didn't break any ribs. And they go, hey, what's that lung mass you have? And they accidentally found a small cell lung cancer at a very early stage, T1, T2, with no lymph nodes. And if you've worked in this business long enough, you've heard these stories where it's like, yeah, it was kind of an accident that we found this, you know, this early stage disease that we can actually resect. Well, for most patients, that's not the case. So you get concurrent chemotherapy plus radiation therapy. So 4 cycles, cisplatin and etoposide. And so that cisplatin and etoposide, if you've been doing this a long time, we've been using that combination like forever. I'm curious what people have to say about this. Not that we can necessarily, we may have more discussion time later, but this 45 gray BID over 3 weeks versus 66 gray daily over 6 weeks, once a day versus twice a day. If you look at that graph there, it looks like, well, that dotted line, that's twice daily, so that's superior, right? If you were to pull up this abstract and this paper from Lancet from 2017, like, I don't know why you would. It's getting pretty old now, but they would say that this actually does not, one is not superior. They did not design this trial to measure that superiority. They actually thought that once a day was going to be superior, and so when this twice a day came out, like, uh-oh, it looks a little bit better. It didn't, you know, it doesn't really meet that. The way they designed it statistically, they can't say that twice is better, but you see that line. So lots of people would say that BID is the standard of care. And then you see there, as I mentioned before, for frail patients, sequential chemo followed by radiation therapy. And then once that's all done, for good measure, and because, you know, this is really how oncology folks got a bad name, is like we like to torture people, I guess, consider PCI, prophylactic cranial irradiation therapy for patients with a PS of 0 to 1 and they're under the age of 70 without neurological conditions. And if you don't meet those criteria, or the patient says, forget it, I ain't doing that, close CNS monitoring with cerebral brain MRIs if no PCI is given. So that's kind of that's how we've been approaching limited stage literally for decades. So if you've read a lot of these durvalumab studies, they're all named after seas. And so there's the Pacific, there's the Aegean. This is the Adriatic. So the Adriatic trial adds IO to definitive chemoradiotherapy for limited stage small cell lung cancer. So you see there, the folks all got chemoradiotherapy initially, and then were randomized to receive placebo versus versus durvalumab. That third arm there that is gray for a purpose, so we're not going to spend a lot of time on it. You're thinking, what is tremelimumab? That's a CTLA-4 inhibitor, immunotherapy. Think about that as like you would, like your ipi-nivo would be durvalumab plus trem, right? So that's similar kind of classes there. So dual primary endpoints, durvalumab versus placebo, looking at overall survival, we're looking at progression-free survival. Secondary endpoints, durvalumab plus trem versus placebo, again, we're not going to talk much about that. And then other secondary endpoints, as you see there. So this is the overall survival. As you see there, that hazard ratio, 0.73, this was significant. And you see there the difference, 33 months with the placebo arm versus 55.9 months with the durvalumab arm. And again, remember, we're telling these patients, hey, this is limited stage. We might cure, your cure rate's not zero. For many years, we just had, you know, observation. And so to see this, a study where you're seeing so many more months in the overall survival advantage, that's you know, where we haven't had any steps forward, here's a big leap forward with the Adriatic data. And then progression-free survival shows similar. Obviously, the numbers aren't as robust as you would expect with progression-free survival. You see there the 16.6 with the durvalumab versus 9.2 with that hazard ratio similar 0.76. And again, at every point there, you're seeing the durvalumab improved progression-free survival over placebo. So here's our Adriatic, the safety profile. You see there some of the things that we talked about. I'll point out hypothyroid is about looks like it's the third thing down, 16% hypothyroid versus 3.8 placebo. So if you were wondering about, if you're one of the folks who didn't get that one right, there's the correct answer right there. I take that first line there. You see that radiation pneumonitis, and we always tell our patients who are receiving IO, oh, you got to look out for the itises. And so pneumonitis is specifically one of the ones we look at for lung cancer. I would take that with a grain of salt. You see that, yeah, actually numerically, the placebo is just like, a little bit higher than the durvalumab, which, you know, it doesn't make sense in our brain thinking, okay, that the person getting IO should have more radiation pneumonitis. Again, this was an abstract that was presented last year at ASCO. I was there when they presented this. Dr. Spiegel presented this, a gigantic room, and much applause when they presented this. But take that radiation pneumonitis with a grain of salt. If you look further down, they say pneumonitis all by itself. And you see there that it was a bit higher. And some of the others, as part of that answer that we were talking about earlier, there's no advantage or disadvantage with the durvalumab. So, hence, we get to add a new box. So the recommended approach now that you see in the really hot off the press NCCN guidelines for small cell version 4/2025, right? So this month, you see there that consolidation durvalumab box is now present. Okay, I'll turn it over to Dr. Hirsch, who's going to talk about management of extensive stage small cell.
Thank you very much, Andy. And what a pleasure these days to talk about something where we see a significant development. I grew up in Copenhagen, Denmark. I don't know if anyone knows where Copenhagen is. During my medical studies there, I started to study small cell lung cancer. I got interest in small cell lung cancer. And as a parenthesis, we developed etoposide. I don't know if you say this has been around forever. Okay. But anyway, I spent 1 year out of my medical studies to prepare for FDA submission of etoposide, and it is still there, but fortunately, there is a lot more to tell about. Next slide, a case presentation. A 67-year-old male with 30-year history of heavy smoking presents with chronic cough and frequent nausea and vomiting. Imaging reveals a large right lung mass with contralateral mediastinal lymphadenopathy and liver metastasis. ECOG status 1. Biopsy confirms extensive disease, small cell lung cancer. And as I said, something has happened also in extensive disease lung cancer. Immunotherapy have come into the scenario also in small cell lung cancer. We had two big studies in extensive disease. We had IMpower 133 studying atezolizumab versus placebo in patients who received conventional chemotherapy. So adding atezo to conventional therapy at that time shows, as we can see here, overall survival and with a hazard ratio of 0.76. So that made the space for atezolizumab in this scenario. Caspian study was kind of a similar study, but instead of atezolizumab, it was used durvalumab as immunotherapy. And we can see here that the study for US showed a hazard ratio of 0.71, statistically different from conventional treatment. So those two big, large prospective studies made the space for immunotherapy, atezolizumab or durvalumab. So this case story we mentioned, 3 months after completing the initial therapy, the patients report new onset chest pain and persistent fatigue. Imaging now reveals progressive disease in the right lung and new liver lesions. A biopsy confirmed disease recurrence. His ECOG performance is still 1. So, with small cell lung cancer, we are talking, and that goes back before immunotherapy actually came into the scenario. We were talking about sensitive and refractory small cell lung cancer. So for patients who have relapsed within the first 6 months, we call them kind of refractory. They haven't really responded well to the first line treatment. And there have been clinical trials studying new drugs, lurbinectedin, topotecan, irinotecan, talatumab, or retreatment with previous chemotherapy. And we have other, we have nivolumab, pembrolizumab, we have new chemotherapies and old ones. And it was a standstill for a long time, in my opinion, second line treatment for patients with relapse less than 6 months. For a relapse more than 6 months ago, more than 6 months during first treatment, there has been clinical trials. Again, the same drugs has been implemented in clinical trials. But here we have a study in second line therapy with carboetoposide versus topotecan, and carboetoposide at that time again showed benefit. So let me go to the most interesting things. Here is what we see these days. We see many new drugs. I will talk about talatumab, I will talk about obrixtamig, a new DLL CD3 T-cell engager. I will talk about Merck's new T-cell engager and some emerging new targets. But before I go there, I don't know if everyone is entirely familiar with the whole new family of drugs, ADCs. ADCs is a variation of monoclonal antibodies. We have known monoclonal antibodies in lung cancer for a long time, particularly in non-small cell lung cancer. You will probably be familiar with cetuximab for EGFR and other antibodies. But ADCs has three components, and it is important to remember that because each component can play a role in the effect of the drug to the target. So it has the monoclonal antibody, it has a linker, and it has a payload. And it gets internalized into the cell, and it goes from the surface of the cell through the cytoplasm to the nucleus of the cell, where it releases the chemotherapy part of it, which is the payload. So three components. Now, we have the bispecific antibodies as well. Bispecific antibodies binds to two different targets, protein targets, on the surface. From non-small cell lung cancer, you might be familiar with EGFR and MET, both targeting in one antibody, but you have several variations, and you have them in small cell lung cancer as well, as I will talk about. And then you have T-cell engaging therapies, where you have an antibody targeting surface of a tumor cell, and on the same time targeting a receptor on the T-cell, so the T-cell get engaged, re-engaged. And we need the T-cells. We need the T-cells to battle the cancer. So T-cell engaging therapies bind to both of them. I know that might probably be well known for all of you, but I will like to everyone to be on that page, same page. So we learned about an DLL3 targeting drugs, tarlatamab, in second line therapy. And DLL3, the tarlatamab, was originally studied in different doses. It was 10 milligram, it was 100 milligram, but they moved on with the 10 milligram in further drug development. And we can see here that this is an Amgen drug, and we can see, I'm guessing you are very familiar with this type of curves. You can see that there was a high response rate to this DLL3 targeted antibody. And the overall response rate was 40%. This is pretty good in a disease which has been very refractory to new treatments. Here was the PFS, and we can see here in second line small cell lung cancer, it is good. What is important though is of course survival. And when I came in this room this morning, my colleagues here said, Fred, have you heard, have you seen the press release this morning that talatamab versus standard of care in second line therapy showed overall survival benefit? And that is what we certainly would like to see. We want patients, of course, we want patients to have a better PFS because that gives also a better quality of life, of course, and they can live longer. But survival is the endpoint we are particularly looking for. And it was a press release this morning that talatamab versus standard of care gave that. Here is US data. It was premature on that stage, but has been updated. But we can see here, it's good. We are talking second line small cell lung cancer, and you know the status of those patients. I'm guessing all of you have been faced with those patients, and we haven't had very good treatment progress in that space at all. So this is the Delphi study, and we see that the responses are not short-lived either. The responses are actually many of them with long duration. And beyond response, we have a number of patients also with sustained disease control. So this is very encouraging. Now, that is not the whole story in the field of extensive small cell lung cancer. There is more to come. Obrituxamib is another drug, and that has been studied also. That is also a DLL-targeted drug, and it is in that is a BI study in relapsed small cell and neuroendocrine tumors. And again, we can see also for this drug that this is very significant response rates, similar. We shouldn't compare one study with another with different drugs, but it is very encouraging, like it was with talatamab. This is much more recent development and a new variation of the drug. And we have also the new Merck drug here in phase one studies coming up with extremely good reports on response. The last studies, we need to see more updates from those studies. We need to see the PFS. We need to see, finally, US data. But talking small cell at that stage, seeing response rates on that magnitude gives us a lot of optimism for the future for extensive small cell lung cancer. And we have also more recently learned about larger studies. This is a phase three study where lurbinectedin, which has been kind of standard of care for second line therapy, is now combined with immunotherapy, in this case, atezolizumab, in the maintenance phase. And there has been a press release there as well that the combination of lurbinectedin and atezolizumab demonstrated significant improvement in PFS and OS compared to immunotherapy alone. So that is probably where we are moving in the future. We have a lot of new drugs. I think we will see those new drugs not as single agents, but in combination with immunotherapy. And that is, in my opinion, where it will take us in the future. And we have other new targets coming up also. We are here another target, B7H3, is an antibody drug conjugate, and we can see here also very promising responses. And finally, another AbbVie drug. It's an antibody drug conjugate, also in an early stage phase development, but with very promising response rates. Of course, those drugs doesn't come for free. As we know, there are toxicity associated with those new drugs. You might be familiar with cytokine release syndrome related to many of those drugs, and those indicate clearly that observation is necessary. I think, Andy, you will talk about that in the next talk. But we seem to learn to manage those toxicity profiles as well in some ways. But of course, when you have the conversation with the patient, it is important that you have this conversation and the patient know what he can expect and what is the premise for those new drugs. So the conversation with patients are important. Even if the toxicity can be significant for many of those new drugs, we see, as I said, ways to manage it and to learn to manage it. One way with, I might take your points for the next talk. I apologize if I do. But DLL3 targeted drugs, some are observing patients 24 hours after each cycle, every cycle. Some are looking into how does this patient tolerate the drug the first cycle. Might be we can be more reluctant for the second and the following cycles. So we learn with each patient, we learn to manage those toxicities.
Sorry, you get me again. So, counseling for patients with small cell lung cancer. Taking into account what we've seen in the last two presentations, what might oncology nursing need to know about those things, in addition to obviously what we already said? Toxicity of T-cell engaging treatments. So this is an interesting slide. I love this slide. So time to onset of tarlatamab AEs. So time to onset from the first dose. So you see there CRS. And of course, the fatter that line is, that's when you're seeing the occurrence of those side effects. So you see that the CRS happened cycle one, day one. And if you were to look up the study, it says 13 and a half hours. That's when you're going to see the CRS, the most of it. You're going to see an excess of 55% CRS, and that's going to scare you. But we'll talk about why maybe it shouldn't scare you. And then you see there that it was CRS. You're seeing, okay, day eight, there's a little bit of a resurgence there. Not quite like day one, though, right? You're kind of the opposite here. Look at the third line there, the ICANS. Nothing, right? Nothing in day one, nothing in day eight, really. And if you were to draw a line there, you would say at day 29, that's when you're seeing the median onset to ICANS. ICANS is only 9%. So if those things, so if you went to a CAR T talk and were thinking, oh my gosh, I was you know, looking at this CAR T talk and they're talking about CRS, they're talking about ICANS, and I don't want to give this for a solid tumor also. Well, okay, 9% with ICANS with TART. Interesting, you see the dysgeusia, and you're like, refresh me, what's dysgeusia? That's your taste is off. And interesting, I like, why does that happen? So I was curious, so what do you do these days? You ask the AI. So what's the AI? So what does tarlatamab target? DLL3. Do we test for DLL3 for small cell for TART? We don't have to, right? Because it's present in 85, 86 to 90% of small cell, regardless of the stage, so we don't have to test for it. So, you know, it kind of makes me sad as a precision oncology guy, we don't have to test. But nonetheless, DLL3. Did you know some of our taste buds exhibit DLL3 as well? And so you see there that day, around day 30, it caused toxicity to the taste buds. So that's why you're seeing that dysgeusia there at around day 30. So impress your friends with that knowledge at dinner tonight. So you see there on the left, this is CRS. So that dark blue line there in the first one of each cycle, that's a total CRS. Now, so you see there at 40, it's stuck there around 40. If you look at some of the combined data, you're going to see a little bit higher numbers in terms of how much CRS are you seeing. But then you see that they're orange and green, and that's the breakdown of grade 1, grade 2. So grade 1, grade 2, those are the ones that are less, I don't want to say they're less worrisome, but you're not necessarily sending someone to ICU when you're grade 1 CRS. And then in cycle 1, day 8, still you're seeing mostly grade 1. The grade 2 really drops off. And there was grade 3, and you probably can't see it there. It's cycle 1, day 1. It's like 1%. If you look there really closely, there's a light blue line in cycle 1, day 1. That's the amount of grade 3 CRS. So this is why I say, at least for tarlatamab, and these aren't necessarily, when you're talking about BiTE therapies or CAR-T, or they're not all created equal. So you might see a new emerging BiTE therapy and thinking, oh, well, that should, it's a high amount of people experience that, but it's mostly grade 1, grade 2s, like TART. Now, pay attention to as those new agents are emerging, because the side effects may be different in profile. Let's move over to the right side here, and you can see, as I mentioned with the ICANS, the majority of that you see is cycle 2, day 1. So again, remember I said day 29 is the median time of onset for ICANS. You see a few there in earlier grades, in earlier cycles, grade 1. But most of that is happening around the beginning of cycle 2. So think about timing, and then the overall incidence of the ICANS is way less than the CRS. And they can also be independent. So you can have ICANS without CRS and vice versa, or you can have both for sure. So this ASTCT, you're thinking, what is ASTCT? And at this moment, I think it's autologous stem cell transplant consensus, something or other. Our stem cell transplant colleagues came up with the grading for CRS. So who was giving a lot of these CAR T therapies where you're seeing CRS? Well, autologous transplant teams were given these drugs. So that, hence, they're the ones who came up with these grading of CRS. So you see there, in grade 1, basically you have a temperature, right? So in the absence of an infection, you see there a temperature greater than 38. As you move over into grade 2, yeah, you still have the temperature, and you have temperature, the fever, grade 2, 3, 4, that persists. You might have some hypotension, but you give them some fluids and that recovers. And you see some hypoxia, but maybe just a little, a little 2 liters of O2 does the trick and gets them over the hump. And as that dissipates, then you can discharge them and send them away. And then as you see there with grade 3, grade 4, you're requiring higher and higher levels. So you're needing vasopressors. You're needing, higher flow oxygens. And then you get to grade 4 where you're seeing, you're requiring multiple vasopressors. You're needing, not only CPAP or BiPAP, but maybe you need a mechanical ventilation. As I pointed out, now, this Delphi 301 study is only 88 people. Right, so they didn't have any grade fours, but it was a small amount of people. So as we move forward, and we're seeing more and more patients go through this, in the real world for sure, but in study as well, we're going to see a grade four, but at least for now, in the study that is in the prescribing information, you don't see that. So what about CRS mitigation? So you have the step-up dosing. So on the day one, you get that 1 milligram. On the day eight and day 15, you go up to 10 milligrams, and in cycle two onward, you're giving 10 milligrams every 2 weeks. There's a typo there. So the cycle one, day one is 1 milligram. Cycle one, day 8 and 15 is 10 milligrams. And then cycle two onward, 10 milligrams every other week. So what do we use? Well, prophylaxis, we give dexamethasone 8 milligrams. 1 hour before the TART, cycle one, day one, and cycle one, day 8 only, right? You give IV hydration 1 liter over 4 to 5 hours immediately after the TART and doses in cycle one, so day 1, 8, and 15, right? So you're giving some things on some days, and then they drop off the farther you get. You're still giving that fluid on day 15. So I'm going to say this hospitalization piece with a little grain of salt. If you look if you really were to magnifying glass the prescribing information for tarlatamab, it says in an appropriate healthcare setting. So what I'm seeing around the country is that sometimes they are giving the drug in an outpatient clinic. Now I say outpatient clinic, it's not outpatient clinic that's 2 hours away from the inpatient clinic or the inpatient unit. It's like the outpatient clinic that's attached to the same building as the hospital, that kind of stuff, where we'll see, okay, you're gonna be technically your outpatient, and then we're gonna wheel you across the hall, and now you're inpatient. Why do they do that? Well, when you talk about an admission, if you know that most people, if they're going to get CRS, it's going to happen at 13 and a half hours. Well, the workday is about 8 hours, theoretically speaking. So if they get there in the morning, you give them their tarlatamab in the morning, and they sit there all day as your guest until like 4 or 5 o'clock, and you transfer them over to the inpatient unit, that 24 hours, you're now a short stay, right? So that's a reason why you can see those different models. And obviously, what works for a particular health system, even within a particular city, you might see it implemented in different ways. It's like, well, geez, our outpatient clinic's way too far from our inpatient unit, so we're going to have to admit all these people. Or, gosh, it's literally across the hall, even though it's technically outpatient. So these are just these kinds of things that people do, that has partly basis in financial, but partly in basis of staffing. And again, it has to fit for your clinic. So day one, day eight, hospitalization required for that, after tarlatamab infusion. So you were talking about CRS, and you think about, you're right. In outpatient setting, we're used to giving drugs where people react, right? But it's usually you're given the drug and it's like, I can turn off the drug and we're going to put up some saline. And no, that drug's been given like 6 hours ago, right? Or 12 hours ago or 13 and a half hours ago. There's nothing to turn off. So it's all about assessment, and maybe they're sitting there getting fluids. Well, you want to keep the fluids going. So it's different in that regard from our traditional, they're having an infusion reaction, because it's not that same kind of reaction. So day 15 in cycle two, hospitalization is not required, but monitoring is for 6 to 8 hours after the infusion. So if that's not plausible for your outpatient unit, well, then you know that you might still require a hospitalization. Again, it's what fits with your clinic. Cycles 3 and 4, hospitalization not required. Monitoring for 4 hours after the infusion, and then if you're making it to cycle 5 and beyond, hospitalization not required, and you only have to stick around for 2 hours. So by that time, you're like, okay, they really are tolerating this drug. So CRS management, so etiology and broad assessment, infectious workup and consideration for broad spectrum antibiotics. Remember I said what is the first thing that people experience? Grade 1, fever. It's like, okay, you're thinking, oh, they got CRS, or do they have COVID? Or do they have the flu? Do they have whatever? You still have to weigh those things and decide, okay, is it infection? Is it CRS? So grade 1, supportive care and monitoring. If symptoms fail to improve after 3 days, well, then you're going to pull out your tocilizumab, right? So this drug is no longer, it's still expensive, but it's not ungodly expensive. You don't have to get permission from the Pope to be able to give it. There's biosimilars now. So, hey, I've talked to some different clinics that go, oh, yeah, we stock, X number of doses per patient who's receiving tocilizumab or who's receiving tarlatamab. And so it's ready to go. So if we're infusing 4 people that day, they've got a bunch of doses of toci in the pharmacy. So grade 2, we jump on the toci with grade 2. We do plus or minus steroids, and then certainly with grade 3, grade 4, you're giving high dose steroids and the toci with it. So think that tocilizumab, it's an IL-6 anti-IL-6 drug, and it can really put the brakes on the CRS. What about ICANS? So we talk about this ICE scoring. Basically, ICE scoring is a neuro exam, and I think the next slide is going to explain what the ICE scoring is. Depressed level of consciousness. So, do you tap on them? They're like, what? What do you need? That's a grade 1 versus awakens to voice, against a tactile stimulus, you're shaking, kind of that sternal rub kind of thing. Or grade 4, the patient's not arousable. So, again, how wakeful or somnolent are they? Are they having seizures? You don't see seizures in grade 1, grade 2. You're seeing motor findings in grade 4. You're seeing elevated intracranial pressure with grade 3, grade 4. So here's that ICE score. So your orientation, for example, to the year, the month, the city that they're in the hospital. Each of those is a point, and for a total of up to 4 points. Naming objects. So it's like, what's that up on the wall? That thing that you tell time with. That kind of thing, and you get 3 points, and then so on. And then you see there the scoring there at the bottom. So this is not like golf scoring. You want a higher score on the ICE score is better. So management. So etiology of neurological changes. So if you look at the neurological changes that occur on this trial, they say, oh, geez, it's almost 50% of patients have neurological changes. Well, what's included in that umbrella of neurological changes? It's headaches. It's it's lots of things. In addition to the stuff that we might consider ICANS. But the ICANS, remember, is just 9%. But there are other reasons why someone might be having neurological symptoms, and we cannot forget about those, right? Consider CTA versus MRI for looking for a stroke or a TIA. Infection can certainly cause, in the short term, can cause those neurological changes. Ensure that you've gotten a baseline exam, an ICE screening, every shift while you're in a hospital, so you know what were they like before. And me remembering, like, well, they were just talking to me, they seem pretty normal, is not an ICE score, right? It's not the same. And I would throw in there, think about brain meds. Again, if someone's walking into your ER or being wheeled into your ER and they're confused and they're out of it, at least in that moment, acutely, you're thinking, could this be brain meds? So those are all things that are in the differential diagnosis of ICANS. So what's our treatment? So if it's grade 1, well, it's just supportive. And this actually, ICANS can persist for a good chunk of time, days or weeks even. supportive care, it may be dex in grade 2 with monitoring, and then you're seeing in grade 3 where steroids and ICU support. Why ICU support? Well, these are people who are, I mean, you can't, you're having to shake them to wake them up, right? And you might require, you know, in grade 4, we're talking about airway support and mechanical ventilation, ICU-like support. So obviously you're going to need a higher level of care. And interestingly enough, you know, we talked about kind of this, you know, compare or contrast with CRS, and you see there that that asterisk tocilizumab does not have a role in isolated neurotoxicity. So again, no. Now, if as a practitioner you're saying, well, you know, gosh, I'm the nurse practitioner who's on tonight in this unit where we gave this person tarlatamab, and I'm not sure if it's all ICANS or if there's a combination of CRS and ICANS. That's your prerogative. You should say, okay, I'm going to give TOSI. I'm going to give DEX. You have to base it on the situation. So even though I say that, geez, it doesn't have a role in this isolated neurotoxicity, if there's combined CRS, yeah, you're perfectly within your scope to give TOSI there. So discussion. So navigating multidisciplinary management. So I talked about how lots of times teams these days, there's not as much resident support, and it's us. You know, it's PAs, it's nurse practitioners, it's advanced practice folks who are manning these units in the middle of the night. And yeah, we have backup on the phone, but there should be protocols in place. There should be you should have that ability, number one, to make, you know, you have to have the knowledge to make the decisions and the autonomy to do that. And so, you know, lots of states, you have the autonomy to do it based on your Nurse Practice Act, but sometimes facilities say, oh, you can't give that. Well, no, if that's within your scope of practice, those things need to be decided upon, not when that person is having that acute CRS or ICANS in the middle of the night. So treatment options and expectations, these are the things that we discuss with patients. So after that 6 to 8 hours of monitoring or 24 hours, you know, at first, you know, and you send them home, they can still have CRS, right? Just because they are done with their monitoring period. So there's a lot, there's the old nursing things still apply, right? So you still need to teach a patient, you know, if you have these symptoms, you have to call us. And you can't just show up at any old ER. You have to show up where we tell you to show up, right? Because we all know that, oh, please do not show up at this ER. I know that one's like 5 minutes from your house. You got to go to that one that's half an hour from your house, right? And if you have 2 hours for those first few doses, you really should be within an hour of that facility. Infection prevention, with that target of DLL3, we do see cytopenias with tarlatamab. So there's the old standbys, right? Infection prevention is still in vogue here. Lifestyle modifications, educational resources and support groups, advanced care planning, and emotional support. Anytime you're talking about small cell, advanced care planning is you know, from day one. I think we've gotten to the audience Q&A.
There are a few questions, and I think most of the questions are actually for your talk. So let me start with one. I had a patient last week with progressing small cell lung cancer, presented to ED with hypoxemia. Hypoxemia required high flow oxygen, started tarlatamab 24 hours after first cycle, first day. The patient's oxygen requirement increased. No temp, nor normal blood pressure. I couldn't tell if it was grade 3 CRS or the disease. We treated it as if it was grade 3 CRS. Would you have done the same?
I think I would have, because we can treat CRS. We're treating the small cell, yes, with the drug, but CRS, there are obviously steps to treat that, and I don't think you're losing anything, and there's not a lot of drawback to giving Dex and Tosi with that. But yeah, I agree, that's probably a grade three. Do you agree with that?
I agree with you too. What type of hospital service are you admitting those patients to? Also, what outpatient system do you have in place if someone receives treatment in the outpatient setting and needs to be admitted? So we are in a highly academic center, and we are in the process of making a specific unit for this type of treatments. But what do you see out in the communities and in the other settings?
Yeah, so I came from a facility that was a community practice, and but the bulk of the autologous stem cell transplants and even and unrelated transplants were being done by a community practice, and so it made sense that so a lot of these studies were done in our clinic. In a stem cell transplant. Now, does it have to be that? I think it's a natural thing because a lot of these units had given CAR T, and so they were used to some of those like CRS. And so I think that's a natural fit. But does it have to be? No. I think that there's support that can be given where you can train any unit to be able to give that, and you said you were given a specialized unit. So that's something that could be done, even if there's no stem cell transplant program that's in place.
Right. What side effects does Tosi have?
I don't know if I've really seen side effects of the Tosi. Have you seen really side effects of Tosi?
I don't have much experience with it either.
Yeah. I'm not seeing too many. I'm not really seeing any side effects that I'm attributing to the rescue drug.
If a patient chooses BID RT, what time space doses? I'm not a radiotherapist, but.
6 hours. So on the study, on the CONVERT trial, I'm acting like I know this. I read it this morning. That's why I know it. It was 6 hours between. And are you doing BID at your clinic? Yeah. And I'm seeing that, but I do see, when I travel around different places, I said, no, we don't do that. We don't have the ability to do it, or they don't have the linear accelerator time to do it, so they're doing them, like traditional. But 6 hours is what it said on the trial.
It was briefly addressed, but what is the most recent recommendation for whole brain radiation, regardless of stage?
So this, you're only going to be doing the PCI in a limited stage,
right?
So you're not giving. So this is whole brain. Basically, the idea is that, okay, there's, if you put them into a remission with whatever you give first line, so if it's chemo radiotherapy, and now as you talked about with the durvalumab, there's a chance that you're curing this person. One of the spots that small cell likes to go is the brain, and so to combat that, really old trial now. It's like, I think this is back in the 90s, really, when that trial, and I'm not calling you old. I graduated high school in the 90s. So, does that make you feel any better? Maybe not.
I was in kindergarten at that time.
Were you? Okay. Yeah, Asians don't age. So it would be confined to limited stage. Again, you're going to be a higher performance status because you have lots of. I've seen lots of these patients after they get certainly in the short term after they get the whole brain radiation therapy. It's like they are speaking and moving in slow motion. It's not fun. But again, if you're trying to give them the maximum amount of, is there a chance that we're going to cure this? That's why you would consider that.
I agree. I think you answered this question, why is IV hydration given over such a long period of time, Vitala? I think you touched upon that.
Yeah, I said you give it over 4 to 5 hours. I guess they wanted to give that volume of a liter. Why over that? Why not give it a liter over 1 hour? I mean, like obviously they're worried about fluid overload if you're giving it faster. There had to be an observation anyway. So I think those are some of the reasons why you would give it over 4 to 5 hours.
Yeah. A barrier to bispecific therapy at our institution is our ability to monitor without a hospital admission. What are some recommendations that you have for that? As I said, we for bispecific therapies, we are working on a specific unit to take care of it, so we get some uniform experience with this type of patients. We do have also hematologic malignancies in our program, mm-hmm. so we do that. But I don't know how the community-based institutions are dealing with it. It varies a lot.
Yeah. So we talked about just briefly about that press release this morning, how maybe, a drug like tarlatamab might be moving up into that really the second line therapy. Right now there's a menu of second line therapies, and right now it's category 2A recommendation and NCCN guidelines for TART. If that moves up into and this is not going to be the greatest answer, but maybe you're sending them to a place that can do it. Now, when you talk about the financial implications of that with a private practice and we're sending patients out, and whether it's, I'm from Cincinnati, if we're sending them to, if we had to send them, for example, to Ohio State 100 miles away, no one feels happy about that. I mean, Ohio State feels happy about that, the Ohio State, they feel happy about that. We want to be able to treat these patients at home. So, so you either bite the bullet and say, we're going to take these therapies and get the training to be able to do this, or you're going to send those folks out, or opt for other treatments, which is always an option as well.
Yeah, I don't think that sending patients out is a solution for the future. I think with the new data, I think tarlatamab actually should be the treatment of choice for second line with those data. That is my personal opinion.
Yeah.
And if that is the case, we need to train people as staff as quickly as possible to manage that.
I agree.
It is not an easy process, even in my institution, which is a highly ranked academic institution. This is still work in progress.
Sure.
We have this as the highest priority on this stage because we need the staff educated to deal with these drugs. They come in very quickly. Tala is only the beginning of it. As I mentioned,
all those ones all have the same target, right?
They have all the same target also.
Yeah,
you're talking about that. I hope we soon come to a stage where we can determine to give the right treatment to the right patient based on selection criteria. We don't have that yet in small cell lung cancer. We are very good at it, in my opinion, in non-small cell lung cancer,
right.
But still dealing with ADCs coming in, we are still dealing with what is the most appropriate biomarker for the ADCs. And I just make a commentary to that in Clinical Cancer Research, by the way. I think it is out this week or the next week. but I hope we can do a better job to select the right patient to the right treatment.